Welcome, welcome, welcome everyone to Whiplash Talk. This is sunshine on a beautiful, gorgeous day. Saturday, the Cuke Train Day. I am so excited that you're here to join me today, and I have a special announcement to make. I have a special guest today, and I am excited to share some information about this person with you, and then I will introduce them and bring them on. So let's just get right to it, because I think it's going to be a packed show, so let's just get on with this. My guest today has had many experiences throughout his life that have prepared him for this moment to launch his own radio show. In hearing his story, it dawned on me that in a way, his entire life from childhood through adulthood has been one big whiplash after another. Michael Deem and I have not talked about the formatting of this show or questions that he may be asked. I asked if anything was off the table, and his answer was no. Therefore, we are going to go with the flow and believe what is shared today will be source-led. Michael's story is powerful, moving, and dare I even say, jaw-dropping. From seeing supernatural religious phenomenon as a child, spending time in, quote, the programs, the secret space program, instant healing of a lifelong medical condition, foretelling of 9/11, being disbarred and railroaded into jail for 6 months for a crime he did not commit, and then in retaliation for disclosing, retaliation for disclosing that New York State is by definition, in his words, tyranny. The New York State Judicial Branch has created a child peonage system in family and divorce courts, and the vast majority of judges in New York State are serial felons under both federal and state law. And having his children stolen from him by a corrupt Masonic and satanic court system. Yet, with this brief overview of his journey, he states, I now know a peace I have never known before. On his show, Michael will explain what he has done to grow his light significantly and find peace. If you have not figured it out by now, this is not your typical Q-Train awakening show. Not only will Michael show you the corruption, unconstitutionality, and very dark side of government, he will explain what you can do about it. Michael will teach you how to spot agents of dark, call them out, and push back against the matrix peacefully, yet powerfully. The show is called Bards Rise. Michael's first show will air on BBS Radio and TV this coming Thursday, March 6th at 6 p.m. Eastern. We all will have to tune in and allow Michael to help us step into our sovereignty, power, and freedom to work together to crash the matrix. I've asked BBS Radio if they would please play Michael's show music for us. It is empowering. It's iconic. Everyone will know Bards Rise is on the air with the first power chord downbeat. After we hear his music intro, I'll invite Michael to join us. BBS, let's hear Bards Rise. Whoa!
Oh, here. Thank you, Sunshine.
You're welcome. That is the best show song ever.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And first, I have to say thank you for inviting me as your first featured guest on your entire show ever. It is a huge, huge honor for me and a privilege. Thank you.
Absolutely. It is my honor and privilege to have you. When I got to know you, Sam, and we started talking, and the first time I met you, I talked about I really don't have people on the show, but I was so interested in your story. And Robin had you on, and you guys did a great job. And I thought, this is great. Robin got it and ran with it. This is perfect. But the more we got to know each other, and the more that I peeled back the onion and learned more about your story, it really kind of slapped me in the face about, and I say this with great respect, I don't mean it to be an insult at all. I say it's like from the word go, your entire life has been one whiplash after another.
There's been some challenges, yes.
And so I thought, well, my people, my listeners, listen to Whiplash Talk because they have been with me for a year now and have been with me through some recent struggles that I went through. And so they kind of understand the whole whiplash, wow, what the heck just happened there? And so thank you from my heart. I thank you for wanting to come on and accepting my invitation.
Well, like I said, it's my privilege, my honor to do so.
Yay! I'm so excited. Okay, well, I think I am going to start with, if I can, let's go to the beginning. Let's start at the beginning because I know we talked about when you were a child. I was fascinated with your story about your grandmother and the story about your daycare. Are you comfortable sharing some of that with us today?
Yeah, sure.
Please go ahead.
So, my father, I was born at Camp Lejeune. My father was in Marine Corps active duty at the time. And I was about 2 years old, 2, 3 years old. And I had my older brother. My sister hadn't been born yet. So, my father had orders to Vietnam. He went there. My mother packed up me and my brother, moved back to Naples, where she was born and raised. And her family has, who knows how long, but centuries going back to Italian roots. And my grandmother was actually part of the Italian royal family. So that would make her what we now know as bloodline. Right. But now looking back with what I know now, she knew stuff, right? And she insisted that I do certain things. Like I always had to hold her hand no matter where we went. And she would take me around throughout the whole city whenever she did errands and stuff or to church. And she insisted I hold her hand. And a couple of years ago, I saw a video of a former Satanist, a female, who said that she used to kidnap children. And she, as soon as she saw skin on skin contact, she would just walk away because she knew it was too hard. Right. And there were a couple other things like that. And then my mother or my grandmother was a devout Catholic, Roman Catholic. And she would take me at least once a week to the traditional Latin Mass when she was a devout follower of this one Franciscan monk, Padre Pio. And Padre, I'm sorry, not Padre Pio, Padre Dolindo. And Padre Pio referred to him, Padre Dolindo, as a saint. So his following took off. And I went there, and there was something about the man. You would just, he was magnetic. And one day I looked up, and he was celebrating the Eucharist, and this non-consuming fire was coming out of the Eucharist. And he also had like a crown of the same light around his head. And I noticed that everybody who received the Eucharist, their aura would increase. So I knew that it was good. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't explain it. Nobody ever talked to me about it, but I knew it was good. And then years later, I saw the same non-consuming fire in a postcard of Padre Pio. And you could tell that whoever took that picture, there were two pictures on the same postcard, one from the front at a slight angle and one from the back at a slight angle. And he had the same non-consuming fire. around his head, only his spikes of white, right, was bigger and thicker, as well as around the Eucharist. It was huge, like the monstrance that you would see the Pope walk around with, and it went down his spine and then kind of like rounded off. It was really something. It was, yeah. And nobody ever talked about it.
So help me understand, because is it okay to say exactly where you are? May I say where you were? What town
I
you
was
were
in Naples. Yeah, I was in Naples, Italy at the time.
You're in Naples.
And then
okay.
We moved back to the States and eventually settled in Westchester County.
Okay, so let's go back to Naples for a second. Talk about your daycare, and I believe you mentioned there was something like a portal. Is that correct?
So yeah, I was in preschool at the time, and I have distinct memories of it, but it's not one long thing, right? I have pictures of it, but I remember this one woman would show up at the nursery school. I don't know where she came from, but they would take me to Rome, and we would have to play this game of kind of like hide and seek. Like I would be walking with her, and I would have to tell her who was following us, where they were, and describe them, what they were wearing, what they looked like. And sometimes it was two people, sometimes it was just one that was following us. And what triggered me is, you know, one time my mother took us to the same exact location because she was up there shopping. And all of a sudden, like, it triggered me. I was like, Mom, let's play this game, hide and seek, just like I do with so-and-so, this woman. And I was trying to explain it to her and trying to do it. But of course you couldn't, because you needed a lot more people and stuff. So the next day, on Monday, when school was back in session, she took me to speak to the nurse, to the nun, right, the head nun. And she said he was telling me about this game that he plays when he comes here. How, you know, somehow he gets to Rome and everything. And she, a nun, Roman Catholic nun, looked my mother straight in the eyes and just lied to her. Nope, I don't know what he's talking about. My mother left. She looked at me and said, "You weren't supposed to tell. You're in trouble." And then I knew, you know, something was going to happen. But I feel and that they wiped my, that was the first time that they wiped my memory. And I want to say that there was a portal in one of the closets with a mirror. I don't know if it was the mirror itself or the back of the mirror.
Wow. Now, in this, if I remember correctly, were they training you in all of the clair abilities? Is that something? Is that correct? I have that right?
I don't remember, but I knew that, you know, certainly, I don't know what you would call it. I'm not that familiar because I really don't get into all that stuff, but it's certainly more than one, right?
Wow.
It was a challenge.
Wow.
Because I wasn't allowed to turn around.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So I've talked to you about this and kind of jokingly, seriously said, "You're so lucky. You're so protected. The source in you has protected you your entire walk, even though you've had hiccups and bumps along the way. It's not luck. It's source, because the light in you still shines and was able to be seen by others, but yet still they kept trying to take you out. I'm in awe." Okay. So we leave. I'm just in awe. Such an amazing path your life has been. Take me from, you leave Italy, you end up back in the States. And at that point in time, what was your age at that point in time, approximately?
Almost five, about 4.5 years old.
Okay. So from that, take me to the point up to when you went into the military. Tell me, what was that time? What was that space like?
I felt like I never fit in. I was the happiest I could possibly be is when I was out in the woods, you know, looking for salamanders or fishing or something like that, you know, playing with my fish in the fish tank. I just love being out in the woods. I come back and you know, the other kids were getting along, and I could get along if I wanted to, but I just wasn't a good fit.
Right. So, what was your catalyst? I'm assuming you graduated from high school, and then did you go into the military in high school? How did that go?
Right. It's funny because, right, what I just described fits very well for elementary school. And part of that also was because I didn't speak a lick of English when I came
Oh,
to the States.
true. Oh, I hadn't
So
thought about that.
they'd have to, my family would have to chaperone me around. And eventually I picked up the language, but I remember kids coming up to me saying, Mike, what do you, how do you call this in Italian? And it was a ball. And then, I was like a fish in a fish tank to some extent.
Right.
It was certainly an oddity. But then that started to wear off as I got older because I became more acclimated to the country and the environment and everything. And then in high school, I was like, I wound up being the typical jock, captain of two different sports, a homecoming king, and all this. But there's always something like it just didn't fit. So from there, I had to go to college. I had no choice.
Right.
My mother didn't have the opportunity. My grandmother did, right? She went to the finest schools, but my mother didn't. She insisted that we all go to college first. So I went to my first year of school, college, and I didn't like it. I really didn't like it. I decided to join the Marine Corps Reserve. There's just a test of water because that's what I wanted to do. But my father was a Vietnam veteran. It was that time, they weren't really appreciated. So I said, let me just join the reserves. I'll test the water. I did, and I absolutely loved it. So that was the motivation for me to finish college. And after college, I was commissioned second lieutenant in the Marine Corps, and I had to go to the basic school, which all second lieutenants have to go to in the Marine Corps. And then just before we graduated from there, they asked if they said that there was a new space program out, and they were looking for volunteers who wanted to go. And there were over, I think, 200 people, 200 second lieutenants in my class, and I'm pretty sure every single one of us raised our hands.
So tell me about that process. Tell me about you all raised your hands and did you all get accepted? Did you have to test for it? Tell me what worked. Tell me what happened.
Well, I don't know what the selection process was. But they said, okay, if you're interested, somebody will be coming around and get your information down. So about 2, 3 days later, another guy in my platoon came down and started going down everybody's roster. Okay, he went to my roommates, the Jesus, are you in secret space program? You in or out? I'm in. Do you want to remember? Yes or no? Yes. And went through the, and then I was the last one. Dean, are you in? Yes. Do you want to remember? No. And it was like the record skipped, Everybody looked at me like, what? How come? I said, I don't know why. I just don't want to remember. And now I credit that to having already been in the programs, and my spirit was saying, you don't want to remember what they're going to put you through.
Yeah, that's really good.
So then they said, okay, a couple days later, same guy came back down and said, okay. Gave us all our appointments. He said, Dean, your appointment is on this day at this time. Don't be early, don't be late. Okay. So that day and time comes. I walk through the door. I see somebody else in my platoon leaving. And I walk up, and there was only me and one of the instructors, Captain Fulfer. He was short, black hair, wore a flat top, dual cool, as we say, a school bubble and jump wings qualified. He was a tactics instructor, infantry officer, of course, right? So I remember this. I remember all these facts. He said, okay, Second Lieutenant Michael A. Dean, space program. You want to be in it? Yes, sir. And you don't want to remember. Is that right? Yes, sir. Okay. He reaches into his pocket, pulls out a little neuralizer, just like on Men in Black. He said, make some adjustments on the top. He says, okay, look right here. Points to the top light. He says, okay, and he pushes a button, he clicks, and it flashes. He says, did it work? I don't know. What's it supposed to do? He goes, I don't think it worked. Let's try it again. And now I realized it was a two-step process, right? So I made some adjustments, got ready. He goes, okay, focus really hard now. And I did. And he flashed it again, and it felt like somebody stuck a giant needle right in the middle of my brain. It had this sharp pain I never felt before. And I've had a bunch of head injuries. And it was right where people describe the pineal gland is. And I couldn't shake it. And he says, okay, that's it. You're done. And as I'm walking back to my room, I noticed that the pain started reverberating out. and everything that was inside that circle, if you will, was going numb. Like my brain was starting to go numb and I couldn't shake it off. And things were starting to disappear. Like all the people in my unit were gone. Their equipment was gone. I looked out. The cars from the parking lot were gone. An instructor said, came by, goes, Dean, go through that door. But sir, they told us to never go through that door in the basement. Lieutenant, I'm telling you, go through that door now. Yes, sir. So I open the door and there's these set of steps about 4 or 5 high, about 4 feet wide, wooden steps. And on each side, there's another tactics instructor. And they go through the same thing, you know, taking down my information, make sure, verify who I am. And I say, okay. And on top of the steps, there was this giant circle. And they said, okay, throw your sea bag through. And threw my sea bag through. They said, step through. And I stepped through. And with that, I was in Area 51, just like that. And that's the last thing I remember. Yeah. And then a couple of days later, I woke up in the same building, in a different floor, different room, with all my clothes put away exactly like how I would put them away. And one of the other guys in the room, like for some reason, the whole unit was in my room, all the lieutenants anyway. Somebody says, Mike, come here. I want to show you something. Okay. So he flashed me again. And after that, I remembered even less.
Wow. So the circle that you threw something through, and humor me if you remember, if you don't understand, is it something like the show on Stargate where it was a circle, but it was kind of a wavy whatever in the middle? It was like an activated something in the middle, or did you just see through to the other side?
No, you couldn't see through the other side, but you couldn't see any waves either, right? It was just flat, opaque.
Wow. Wow. Okay,
and it's so, right there, right inside the military base.
Oh,
you hear
God.
All the stories and stuff, you don't realize just how close everything is.
Right. And where was this base? Where were you based at?
Quantico, Virginia. The base.
So you were in Quantico. Yeah.
In the BOQ, Bachelor's Officers Course.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. And so I'm going to take
that.
Go ahead.
If you don't mind, I just throw out there.
Please.
I'm sure, I'll bet dollars to gumballs, that my unit was not the only unit that this question was posed to. So if you know any Marine Corps officers out there, in fact, I'd say any officers from the military branch, ask them that question. Were you ever asked to if you wanted to join the space program? See what they say.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. So I want to play off of this, but then I want to go back to, your foretelling of 9/11. But let me stay on this one for a second. You and I have talked about calls with Anthony and Q, and a lot of people that listen have also listened to those calls with Anthony and Q. Was this the first time you met Q after the secret space program, and on the calls with Anthony and Q? How did you get connected with Q?
Right. I had listened to some of his videos, right? Mm-hmm. And at first, when I first heard him, it didn't resonate with me. Mm-hmm. But the next time I heard him, when I heard him speak, I had this vibration, like my entire body just vibrated. And I just knew that he is who he says he is, right? In the Bible, to say his sheep will know his voice.
Yeah.
And that's what I kept thinking about, because at the time I was Catholic. But now I just know that, you know, he resonates with, you know, other light beings. So
right.
I heard him say on one of his shows that he likes helping people that served at Area 51 get their memories back. And I was like, well, that's me, you know. So I reached out to Antonio. He set up the meeting, and it was Antonio, Q, and me. And during that time, I had been diagnosed with ADHD. When I was about 30 years old, right, when I went to law school, I'd already done my active duty in the Marine Corps. And I noticed that when I'd read, it just took me a lot longer to read, and I wouldn't remember a lot of the stuff that I read. I was like, there's something going on.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with, I went to a tutor, right, to get ready for the LSATs. And the guy looked at my test scores. He's like, you can think, brother. You know, he goes, but look at these scores. Like, you get all these right, and then, like, you get 2 wrong in a row. It's like you're there and then you go away somewhere. And then you come back and then you go away somewhere. So I decided to get myself tested, and I tested positive for ADHD. So fast forward to my meeting with Q. He explained that I had an overlay. I guess in the program, when people start rejecting the programming and stuff or what they're being asked to do, they start pushing back. And when that happens, they'll be given a pill. Sometimes they'll be given, I don't know, a barcode or something, an insert. And he goes, but sometimes you reject that as well. And he said,
Michael,
and that's what happened to you.
right. And when you say in the program, you're talking when you were at Area 51.
Yes.
Okay, keep going. Okay. So that's
So
what
he
happened to
said,
you.
you rejected everything they gave you, so you had to go in a chair and you got the overlay, which I guess is, and he says, do you want to get rid of it? I was like, absolutely. So he says, okay. And took a minute or two, whatever. He did what he had to do. And he says, okay, how do you feel? I said, at peace. For the first time in my life with ADHD, like my entire life, think of it as a car with an idle that's revving really high. That was basically me and my mindset, like my entire life. But it got worse as I got older because of the other stuff that they were, giving me, especially with that overlay. But once he was done and he got rid of the overlay and did what he did, it was gone like that, instant.
Nice. So nice. So I believe you said that some of the programs you worked on, Q was familiar with.
Right. According to Q, he was in the same programs, and I took over some of the programs that he created. There was a gap in time of about 12 years between him leaving and me entering the programs.
Wow. Wow. So fascinating. So fascinating to this girl that doesn't know all of that about herself yet, but I'm getting there. Okay, so I know, right? So moving on, you told me that you had a foretelling of 9/11. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Tell my listeners.
Yeah, sure. So after active duty, I left the military completely. And then when I was in law school, I decided to get back into it. And I joined the reserves, and I was with the reserve unit for several years after that. And at the time, I just before 9/11, right? I was the CO, commanding officer of a reserve infantry rifle company. And I was just looking at social media and I would see stuff. And I just had this intuition that something big was going to happen to where we were going to have, excuse me, a major, major deployment and to include an activation of the reserves within a year. And I remember one time, so I was doing everything I could to prepare my unit for that, right? Because my responsibility was to train them, prepare them to go to war, do their mission, and come back in one piece, as many as possible. And in order to do that, you have to train hard, which isn't okay. In the reserves, it's tough because these guys are working 12 hours a day at least once a month. And it takes its toll, not on them, but also their employers and their family who didn't sign up for this. So I remember one time they asked me before a drill, sir, why are we pushing so hard? So I stood in front of my entire unit and I said, based on what I'm seeing on social media, I believe, and like I said, there's going to be something major. And that was in February or March of 2001.
Wow.
We all know what happened September 2001.
Wow. Did they bring that back up whenever it happened? Did they? You told us. You told
Because people were looking at me like, oh yeah, he's out of his mind, and I was asking them to do things that were just taboo, like you just didn't do it. If you look on the table of organization, there's active duty Marines, staff NCOs that are supposed to mobilize and go to war with the reserve unit and actually work for a reserve, officer. And the reserve officer, you're just a reservist, we're active duty, that whole, rice bowl fight. And I and but because they had an integrated billet, I required them to actually drill with us and fill those billets during the training, weekends. And they absolutely hated me for that. But at the end, 6 months later, they looked at me like, holy shit, this guy was right. And I told him, I said, you are now in the best position you could possibly be in based on what I've done. I said, and don't stop, keep going from here. And because of what I did, they were the first unit to deploy within the entire regiment.
Wow. Thank you for preparing them to help them be safe and to get back home to their families.
Thank you. I did my job.
I know it was your job, but sometimes we're not thanked for the jobs that we do. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, let's start. We've got about 30 minutes to go, probably about 25 minutes to go, somewhere around there. I really want to get into, how does someone like you, that is a go-getter, jock in high school, go-getter, Marine guy, reserve guy, leader, how do you go back to school and get your degree, your Juris Doctorate, to be, I'm going to say lawyer, but they say attorney, to do that, and then you get disbarred and railroaded and thrown into jail for 6 months? How do you want to start that story?
Yeah, I'm still scratching my head on that one too. But I got the answers. I know why.
Okay.
So I left active duty, got a job with Airborne Express. I was very fortunate to get it because that was in the middle of the big drawdown. I had planned to stay in the Marine Corps, but Clinton reduced the size of the military by, like, I think it was half. So finding a former military officer I was a dime a dozen.
Right.
And Airborne Express is what took it. I realized that wasn't for me. So my brother and all of his friends were saying, either go back to school, either get an MBA, which doesn't teach you anything, or go and get a JD, which you can hang a shingle eventually and do something. So that's what I did. But I realized I didn't want to hang a shingle. I wanted to be a prosecutor. And that was the only thing that got me through law school, because I absolutely hated it. I didn't agree with some of the, talk about here, CRT, right? Critical race theory. I actually took a class on that in law school. And the professor was an absolute lunatic. And I also had her for torts. And she could just tell, like, this guy isn't getting, falling in with the program. So I was ostracized for that reason alone.
Right.
But eventually I graduated. I put my applications out and I couldn't even get an interview. Now I'm like, okay, well, I wasn't law review. They say if you're not law review, you're not going to get anything. I'm like, well, so I started building houses. I started framing out houses and I was perfectly content. I had, I graduated with the JD a few months early. I couldn't care less about that if I couldn't be a prosecutor. And somebody said, no, you're a lawyer now. You need to start working as a lawyer. So I took their recommendation and eventually I got a job working for the county doing civil law.
Mm-hmm.
That gave me an opportunity to see the underbelly. And I heard a lot of, a lot of stories because politics were just absolutely raging here in Westchester. To give you an idea, in Westchester County, the Clintons obviously live here, the Soroses, the Rockefellers, the Cuomos, and others. And there are many Fortune 500 CEOs, et cetera, live in Westchester, one of the premier counties around in the suburbs of New York City.
That's good to share, because we that are not from there don't know that. That was really good information. Keep going. Yeah. I'm sorry.
And, they say George Soros is appointing or getting all of these lunatic district attorneys throughout the country. Well, first, he's going to take care of his own backyard, right? So when I figured out what was going on, I realized that the county executive, civil, and the district attorney, criminal, are going to be in the back pocket of the really high up cabals.
Wow.
So, but at the time, I didn't know, right? I was just going about my business. They had tried to push me out after being on the job for like 6 months. That didn't.
Hey, Michael, what time of year? What year frame was this?
I'm sorry. This was 2001, August 2000. About the summer of 2001 is when I first got the job. So a few months later, 2001 happened.
Okay, perfect. 9/11. Okay. Sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
No, that's okay. So I got activated for 2011 with the New York Naval Militia, state military. I was down at Ground Zero providing security around a pile for like 7 weeks.
Wow.
Eloped after that with who I thought was, you know, the woman for me. But they didn't want me there. They wanted me out. So after being there for over 8 years in a hostile work environment, I finally said, you know what? I'm going to just hang a shingle. So I hung a shingle. And somebody told me, you have to take whatever walks through the door. You can't be choosy when you first start opening up. Okay, so the type of work that came through were a couple closings, but mostly civil rights work. And I was looking at this as, you know, long-term employment. So I needed to learn. I really didn't know federal law, et cetera. So I started taking cases, and the big person and the DOJ had just come out with a report that the local jail was had a custom and practice of violating the rights of various inmates, et cetera, and denying them medical and dental care. And okay, so that's what walked through the door. I took it and wound up suing the people that I was working with a couple months earlier. Well, they didn't like that. And to make a long story short, I wound up taking a bunch of cases, at least 10, 15 cases at any given time for a few years. And they eventually got every, they would have monthly meetings. They were called the Mike Dean meetings, I'm told, by two different people. And the purpose and the object of the meetings were to, quote, get Mike Dean. Because
wow.
Now they tried to fire me, you know, a few years, 8, 9 years earlier, they couldn't do it. Now I'm suing them and I'm making them look ridiculous. So they had to shut that down. And they tried to hurt me financially by delaying things, making me do everything 2, 3, 4 times, all the paperwork. And the judges were going along with it. They couldn't care less. And I was like, you know, enforce the rules. And I'd come out with cases that were on point. They couldn't care less. Okay. So eventually that all petered out. I was able to settle, you know, a handful of cases, 2 or 3 cases, even cases that were absolute winners. They would cite a different provision of the law just to make me lose. So then I'd have to appeal, et cetera. It was lawfare right before I knew what that term was. So I wound up taking a job with a firm doing basically the same work.
Michael,
but yeah.
Define for our listeners lawfare so they'll know what that means.
Okay, lawfare is when you use the legal system to basically wage war to hurt somebody professionally, financially, their reputation in the community. So basically you're conducting mini warfare against an individual for legal purposes, political reasons.
That's basically what
President Trump went through. I've said for many years, the only person more in America that's more persecuted than me is Donald Trump.
Well, that's such a nice badge of honor to wear.
Yeah. So eventually I left law altogether. I wound up taking, a couple other jobs. And in the summer of 2017, I realized what was wrong with my marriage. It wasn't just, you know, a personal thing. It was, I don't want to say this without being too crass, but you have to appreciate it, right? Because it falls into what we're dealing with now. I discovered that my now ex-wife was a closeted bisexual sex addict that met the criteria for all four cluster B personalities, antisocial, sociopath, borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and there's another one that escapes me. And she also met the criteria for being a, quote, psychopath under this other test that you can take. And it's actually one of only two tests that you can take for somebody else and have it still be accurate. So she was off the charts, like batshit crazy. And I found out later it's because she has dark entities in her and she serves the dark. Well, I didn't know that at the time. So I realized this isn't going to, you know, work. I refused to put up with what she wanted. So I filed for divorce. And because there were two children involved at the time, now they're over 18, they appointed an attorney for the children, my children, even though I disagree with it. And I refused to go along with their court-appointed evaluator. He wanted to do a psychological evaluation. Well, for legal reasons, again, I'm trying to keep this short. But if you agree to that, basically, he can say whatever he wants about you, and then your children go away. You know, he recommends that you not have them, or he might recommend that I get certain type of counseling, and the court is just going to go with it, right? Even though I'm perfectly normal. And I knew that I was being railroaded, not only by her lawyers, but by this court-appointed attorney for the children, because that court-appointed attorney for the children, Faith Miller, should never have been on my case. She, because of who her husband was. Her husband was married to, you know, the top judge within the within my entire department, which is a quarter, actually over 50% of New York State. So she had a conflict of interest for that reason alone. She helped get the judge that was had my case elected and donated to her campaign just 6 months earlier. I was like, this is ridiculous. And she said she recommended she recommended that all contact with the children be stopped until I agree to submit to their psychological evaluation. And she goes, unless he's willing to agree to supervised therapeutic visitation. Well, supervised is when you're doing something wrong with the children.
Oh, no.
And there wasn't. Right? Nothing ever. And therapy is when there's an improper relationship between the parent and the child. And the classic examples would be when the parent has a substance abuse problem and the child winds up taking like the parental role, like making sure that the parent is up, dressed, clean, and out of the house in the morning to get to go to work. And they clean up all the bottles or the drug paraphernalia. There was nothing like that. And I specifically asked them multiple times, well, what's the therapy for? Well, you'll figure it out when you go see the therapist. I'm like, the hell I am, you know? No, because if I agree to go to the therapist, then that means that they can say whatever they want about me, including lies. And that's what goes. So, and they made me pay for those visits as well. And I'm like, no, this isn't happening. So eventually, you know, time after time, I was involved in this divorce for, I don't know, 2-3 years. They didn't. And again, look at my legal background, right? I've been practicing law for 18 years. So I know discovery. I know how it's supposed to go. I know how court appearances and conferences are supposed to go. And they weren't going like that. I was just getting shut down time and time again.
Michael, what year was this? Around what time was this?
This was around, I filed in late 2017. So around 2019 is when it really started getting hot and heavy. And this was after the trial, too. And I finally looked at the judge one time, Gretchen Walsh. I mean, what a POS she is. I looked at her and I said, and this is after, right? I had been red-pilled in the summer of 2020. So now I knew what was going on.
Okay. All right.
And I just started discovering all this stuff online, and I'll really get into the details on my show, but essentially there's been a satanic ritual fireplace inside New York's highest courtroom for over 140 years. And
this is a Masonic, like a Masonic.
Yeah, Masonic. They have the Masonic, you know, insignia there on the floor of this old rotunda. You see the chief judge with the hand signs. You see other paintings, you know, portraits of former chief judges with the hidden hand inside the suit. So it's all there, right? And she's got the pedophile earrings, you name it. She's got the clothes, the Masonic colors and patterns, and all that will be on my show. So, again, I'm trying to keep it short for yours. But I asked her, I said, have you ever been affiliated with secret society, club, or cabal? And with that, her mouth just dropped. I said, to include Freemasonry or the Eastern Star. And now she started going side to side, like her head was moving about 3 to 4 feet apart. And she was shifting her chair. It looked, she had a look on her face, looked like I had just ripped off all of her clothes in the middle of Times Square during rush hour. She didn't know. She was looking for a hole to jump out of, right?
Wow.
So then I got my answer. So I turned around, I asked the attorney for the children. This is a different one. Mm-hmm. And then same question for her. Oh, I don't think that's any of his business. Really? Okay. So I got my answer. And I said, same question for my ex-wife's lawyer. I'm not answering that. I'm not answering that. So I got my answer. So, and this all goes to constitutional rights, right? Because you have an absolute federal constitutional right to due process, which includes being judged by a neutral arbitrator. Well, I wasn't. I got judged by the Yaya Sisterhood. You know, they decided what was going to happen with me in the back door and without me being there.
Wow.
So nothing I did. And they eventually wound up stealing everything I had, to include my children, no contact. So again, to try and make this shorten this story, there were certain orders of protection. I waited until there was just one that was published by this judge because she didn't have jurisdiction to issue an order of protection. So I said, if I'm going to violate it, knowing that I'm going to be arrested, and then when I'm arrested, I'll go to criminal court. It's a higher burden of proof. So nothing that happened in civil court will matter. We'll only focus on whether or not there's a valid order of protection, and it's not. And then I'll be able to see my children again, because otherwise they're going to just keep extending this bogus order of protection year after year. Well, it didn't work out that way.
Wow. Okay. Okay. I'm going to have to, I want you to give me like a one or two liner to where we can wrap this into something, because I want to be able to tell people how to find your show, because people are going to need to hear what you say. So tell me, you can wrap that up as best you can, but tell me why Bards Rise. Why are we launching this show this coming Thursday?
So to really condense it down, basically the criminal trial, I was denied. The prosecutor asked for the court to deny me my right to explain that the judge didn't have jurisdiction and all these other, you know, fundamental issues why the case should have been thrown out. He granted it. And I wasn't allowed to explain what the truth was. And because of that, the jury came back, I think it was like less than 10 minutes. Sending me guilty.
Oh my gosh.
I was sentenced to 6 months. I did all 6 months because I refused to give them a DNA sample because I heard Q say, never give up your DNA. So I followed Q.
Good for you, but yikes. Yeah. But,
okay. I'd do it again if I had to. And he put in another order of protection for 5 years, no contact with my children, regardless if I see, you know, supervised therapeutic visitation. And I asked him why. He says, because you violated the other order of protection. No reason. And then I was disbarred because I was helping some friends of mine over out by Buffalo. And it's a child peonage system. Basically, they use the children as an excuse to appoint their goombas, as we say here in New York, as an attorney for the children. The attorney for the children couldn't care less what happens to the children. In fact, it's actually good if something bad happens, because then they have to come back to court and he gets to make more money, right? It's kind of like they're the human cargo that he's riding on top of. And I kept filing papers, and they said that I was harassing the court with my papers, which is an absolute lie. And because of that, I was disbarred. What really happened is I cracked the code on how to get rid of the court-appointed attorneys for the children. And I'll explain that to you on my show. I fully intend to explain all of this to everybody so that their souls, their spirit can rise. In The Ringing Cedars of Russia, book 3, I believe it's chapter 10, it talks about the bards. The bards were this ancient people in Scotland, or I want to say Scotland. And when the Roman Empire was fighting against the bards, they knew that they were ferocious fighters, and they would have to have a 6-to-1 advantage in order to win the battle. And the final battle where they destroyed, you know, I guess the last stronghold, they were actually outnumbered 9-to-1. And Anastasia explains that battle. Anastasia, who we now know as the mermaid, Ra, explains, you know, that last battle to us in that chapter. And I know I know that there's a lot of bards out there, their spirits, and I want to reach out to them because we need to them. We need them now.
We need them more than ever. I agree. I love what you're doing, and I support it wholeheartedly. I thank you so much for being a part of the show. I think my Whiplash Talk folks are going to be tuning in on Thursday at this coming Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Is that right, Michael?
Correct. Yes.
At 6 p.m. Eastern to listen. Are you a 1 hour show right now?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So that's on BBS Radio and TV, guys, this coming Thursday, March 6th at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's called Bards Rise. You already heard his music. And actually, I know we're probably supposed to go out with my music, but maybe we'll go out with yours again if BBS can cue that back up. That'd be a lot of fun. Any other last minute words? We're about 2:56. They're probably going to give me about 2 more minutes, and then they're probably going to shuffle us off to Buffalo. But any other last minute words to tell people to come see you and how you plan to help them? I love that you use the words peacefully and powerfully. You're not looking for people to go out and grab their ARs and go out and wipe out governments.
No, not at all. Just listening to what Ross said, right? This is all inspired by her words. If everybody just pushes back just a little bit, that whole ball of yarn, right? The matrix will just collapse. Well, I can teach people, and not just in America, across the world, on how to fight back in a peaceful manner. We really can bring this down to a quicker end anyway. We can all be part of this. And there's so many ways that you can do it. And just listening to Q's show today, was somebody called in during the homesteading show. And I was thinking, I can help her. I can tell her, you know, what to do with those 241 and 242 claims.
I was thinking the same thing when I heard that. I was like, oh my goodness, I hope she's listening to my show, because this could really, really help her. Yeah.
And
Michael,
just,
thank you. Go ahead.
Just real quick, everybody should listen to this show. If you're in the FBI, if you're in the DOJ, listen to my show. I know I've sent a lot of this material out to headquarters and other people. It's been out there, but you'll get it directly. And once you understand, and it won't take long for you to pick up on it and run with it, as well as anybody who lives in New York, who's been involved in the New York juridical system, court system. And if you're in a different state and you're in a position to where you have to enforce or being asked to enforce an order from a New York state court, I'll explain to you why you should not do that, because it's an unconstitutional government according to the federal constitution. I'll explain it to you. Don't enforce New York.
I love it. We have 1 minute left, and I just want to encourage you to hear the harmonics that Michael has. He has a heart. He's been through so much, my Whiplash family. He's been through so much, but yet he's worked hard on himself, and he's put the time in to not be bitter. He just wants to be better, and he wants to help others. So I encourage you guys all to join Bards Rise this coming Thursday, March 6th at 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio and TV. I believe he's going to be on Station 1. They don't have his banner up yet, but I believe he's on Station 1. And I think we're going to go out with Bards Rise music. Michael, are we good with that?
Yeah. And thank you again, Sunshine. Thank you. I love you.
You're welcome. All right, let's go for it. Let's go out with Bards Rise, and let's all like peacefully and powerfully push back against the matrix. Thanks, BBS. Love you. Bye. Whoa. Whoa.